So welcome, everyone. I'm here today to talk about the Unreflect. I'm Rick. First of all, I'd like to thank the organizers of the event and you all for being here. The goal of this talk is to present, it's not actually to present my work, it's mostly to introduce you guys to the Unreflect and then to show a little bit of the contribution that I did to this whole thing when I was working on this paper here for last year. So the talk is organized as follows. First, I'm just going to briefly introduce the Unreflect. Then we're going to talk about the KMS condition, which is a notion of thermality in quantum field theory. And then I'm going to introduce three different perspectives, three different ways of talking about the Unreflect. One is via the Rindler modes, which is the most usual one, I would say. The second one is what I'm calling the AQFT perspective. And the third one is going to be the detector perspective, which is the one that I've worked with the most. But I think it's worth seeing all the three of them. And then I'm just going to talk about the contribution that I did essentially to this thing and summarize it. So this is the outline. So the Unreflect is this phenomenon in which accelerated observers in the vacuum experience a thermal bath of temperature essentially proportional to their acceleration. So the first thing to notice about the Unreflect, which is kind of interesting, is the fact that there are three very important constants of physics that show up in the formula for the Unruh temperature, right? So H bar is the fundamental constant of essentially quantum mechanics, right? C is the constant of relativity, KB of thermodynamics. So in a way, the Unreflect contains all these three fields of physics. And it's interesting to be studied simply because of this, but also it's related to more interesting things such as Hawking radiation and well, overall, quantum field theory. But if you've never heard of the Unreflect, then probably you're reading accelerated observers in the vacuum and thermal bath, and you're thinking, how? What's going on here? Like, what does that even mean to do C temperature in the vacuum, right? So the goal of the talk is essentially to try to explain what's going on here, right? So, all right, first, let's talk about the KMS condition, which is the notion of temperature. It's a more general notion of temperature in quantum mechanics overall. So if you've ever done quantum mechanics with thermodynamics, you've probably used the Gibbs states. So the e to the minus beta h, right? You wrote e to the minus beta h as your density operator. This corresponds to the probability of each one of the energies and stuff like this. And this z is the partition function. So in the end, this is how we usually see quantum thermodynamics for the first time, or at least thermal states in quantum mechanics for the first time. Now, the thing is, this doesn't work in general. So specifically in quantum field theory, this trace of e to the minus beta h, this cannot be computed. This is not going to work in general setups. So what we need is this more general notion, the KMS states, right? So let's briefly define the KMS states, or at least give some intuition of what they are. So if we have a time-independent Hamiltonian, time evolution operator is e to the minus iht, right? And then this time evolution operator defines a notion of time evolution in the Heisenberg picture, which evolves states in time, right? Essentially, you conjugate the operators with the time evolution operator. Now, the KMS condition is something that is phrased in terms of periodicity and imaginary time of this time evolution. So it's possible to show that every Gibbs state satisfies this condition here for the correlation of any two operators. So what's happening here is you're time evolving A, and you're leaving B there. And here, the other side, you're time evolving A, but there's this I beta that you add here. So it's some kind of periodicity, anti-periodicity, because you have to invert the order. But this is a condition that every single Gibbs state satisfies. And you can see this from, it's not magic, it's just like one is e to the minus beta h, and the time evolution is e to the iht, and e to the minus iht. So if you just factor the it inside the beta, then you get this periodicity condition, essentially. So, and every Gibbs state satisfies this, okay, for any operators A and B. And moreover, if you have any operator that satisfies this condition here, for any density operator that satisfies this condition here, for any operators A and B, then it will be a Gibbs state if a Gibbs state is well defined. So essentially, this means that Gibbs state satisfies this, and this implies Gibbs states whenever Gibbs states make sense. So this is a more general notion of thermality overall. It's this periodicity or anti-periodicity, if you will, in imaginary time. Okay, cool. So that's the KMS condition. Now I can talk about the Unreflect. We're going to discuss three ways, as I said, of seeing the Unreflect. The first one is via Rindler modes. So the idea is essentially to talk about different ways of quantizing fields or of handling quantum fields overall. Then we're going to talk about the AQFT perspective, which is a more mathematical one. It's more formal, and it's associated to handling the field as an operator value distribution. Then we're going to talk about the detector perspective, which is when we couple a localized non-relativistic quantum system and pose it to be uniformly accelerated and see whether it thermalizes. So we're going to use a thermometer, okay? So first one, and if you ever want to see about these three perspectives, how to compare them and stuff like this, I really recommend this paper here, which is The Under Effect for Philosophers. It's a paper of philosophy of science. It's amazing. It's great. It's good. So recommend it. Okay, cool. So let's go for the first. First one is the Rindler modes perspective, right? So the idea is, usually when we handle a quantum field, we choose some modes, UK, which satisfy the Klein-Gordon equation. So for instance, in Minkowski spacetime, we would pick the plane wave solution or something like this, right? Then we write the quantum field like this, in terms of these creation and annihilation operators, then they will satisfy the commutation relations, and we have our quantum field. And the vacuum state of this field is defined as the state that is annihilated by all of the annihilation operators. Nice. But there's this word here, choice. We choose the modes, then we decompose the field. And then after we choose the modes, we decompose the field, we get the operators, then we get the vacuum. So in a way, this vacuum here depends on a choice. So what I mean is, we could go there and we could choose another choice of modes, so these V, for instance, which would also be a basis of solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. We could write the field like that. Then we would get these operators BK and BK dagger, which would be creation and annihilation operators as well. And then we would define a vacuum at zero prime, which will be annihilated by all of these operators. And now the question is this cat zero prime the same as cat zero? And the answer is, in general, no. These vacua will not be the same. These vacua will be different if you choose different modes with different, essentially, notions of positive and negative frequency. So what we call the vacuum depends on this choice of modes. And we usually say that the vacuum is the no excitation of the field, right? But when we say no excitations, it's no excitations with respect to a given mode decomposition. You need to talk about this mode decomposition. So how do we handle this? Are we doomed? Is there no way of defining a vacuum in quantum field theory? Is everything that we've ever done wrong? No. The thing is that in some scenarios, it's possible to associate modes with physical situations. So for instance, what we do in Minkowski spacetime, we pick the plane wave basis of solutions. And then what happens is we get this Minkowski vacuum, which has the physical interpretation that it's the vacuum such that inertial observers see no particles. So that makes sense when we're doing our experiments, I guess. And also, it's this state here is invariant under the symmetries of Minkowski spacetime, which is great because then it respects the symmetry of spacetime. Then you can argue that this is somehow a good vacuum. But if we want to talk about uniformly accelerated observers or the Under Effect, what we could do is we could solve the Klein-Gordon equation using Rindler coordinates, right? So these are Rindler coordinates psi and tau associated to a uniformly accelerated observer with acceleration a. And if we solve the Klein-Gordon equation using these coordinates here, what we get is now a new basis, say Vk, a new basis of modes. And this will define a new vacuum, which we call the Rindler vacuum. Now, having the Rindler vacuum, this Rindler vacuum and the corresponding creation and annihilation operators sort of define a notion of what are particles for these uniformly accelerated observers. And if you have that, now you can ask yourself, what would be the expected value of the number density operator of this creation annihilation operators associated to the uniformly accelerated observer if the field is in the Minkowski vacuum? And if you ask yourself that question, compute this, what you find is essentially a Planckian spectrum. So this is a Planckian spectrum. This is a thermal distribution with temperature, inverse temperature 2 pi over a, or temperature a divided by 2 pi. So that's the first derivation of the Under Effect. Of course, I didn't derive it, I just stated it, but well, okay. But the thing is, there are two issues with this derivation, or at least two things that I particularly don't like about them. The first one is we require to talk about the Rindler modes, which are intrinsically non-local. These modes are defined everywhere in spacetime, and we need to use these whole modes defined everywhere in order to talk about the temperature for a local observer that's undergoing an accelerated trajectory. That's kind of unpleasant for me. And the second one is that actually this Rindler vacuum is non-physical. It has a divergent energy density in these light cones here. So actually, I mean, it's easy not to be convinced by the derivation, let's put it this way, or at least for me. So let's talk about a second perspective. So the second perspective is the AQFT perspective. So AQFT is algebraic quantum field theory. And in algebraic quantum field theory, there's this very rigorous mathematical treatment for the quantum field. I'm not going to do any of this. I'm just going to give you two things that might be important for us, and then just talk about the KMS condition. So the basic idea, one of the basic ideas of algebraic quantum field theory, is that the field is an operator value distribution. So it acts in past functions. And then this operator here, while the phi of x is not well-defined technically, the phi of f is a well-defined element of an algebra. And then you can perform operations with this, talk about, you can prove theorems with these things. Sometimes you'll have to do some other stuff, but overall this works reasonably well. And then in AQFT, the states are functionals which will map operators to the expected value. So for instance, if I had a density operator rho, the idea is that now I'm going to think that rho is a map that maps the field observables to the expected to their expected value, right? So the way to go from what we used to call states to states in AQFT is this. This is the relationship between them, okay? So this is what a state is. And the good thing about AQFT is that now we can talk about thermality in terms of the KMS condition. Because now the KMS condition, all of these expected values are properly well-defined. And the idea is, if we have a notion of time translation that acts in the operators, essentially, in the field operators, then you can rewrite now the KMS condition in terms of this new notion of this antiperiodicity in this notion of time translation, or imaginary periodicity with period beta corresponding to the inverse temperature. Okay? So, and if this state rho satisfies this for every single operator A and B in the algebra of the quantum field theory, then you're going to say that this state is a thermal state with inverse temperature beta, or it's a KMS state with temperature with inverse temperature beta. And the nice thing here is that it's possible to relate this to the Henry fact, because there is a notion of time translation that is kind of associated with these trajectories. So with these uniformly accelerated trajectories. These trajectories are orbits of the boost operators, essentially, if you apply them to Minkowski spacetime. So the idea is you have the boost generators. If you apply them, you get these orbits. And these also define a time evolution notion, a notion of time evolution that you can act in your quantum field. So the idea is if you apply the boost generators to your quantum field, you're then going to be evolving them on time. So this will define this operation alpha of tau, which can be seen as a time evolution operator. And now, the big results by Bisignano and Wichmann in 1975 was that actually the Minkowski vacuum that is invariant under the translations and these symmetries, is actually a KMS state with respect to the time evolution generated by these boosts. So it is a thermal state with respect to that, right? And moreover, if you adjust this tau parameter here to correspond with the proper time of a uniformly accelerated observer undergoing a trajectory, then you also find that this the imaginary period is 2 pi divided by a. So once again, the Henry fact. Okay, so this is the second derivation. Now, I still have some issues with the AQFT perspective. They're not as serious as the first one, but well, the first one is, in a way, it's also non-local because you have to apply the whole boost generators to the field operators and to the state. And then you have to compute the expected value in the state, which is defined everywhere. But in a way, you can also talk about local field operators. So you can kind of fix that. This remedies this a little bit. But the real issue that I have is that there's no real physical time evolution associated to this alpha tau. You're applying this family of boosts and stuff, but it's very hard to associate this with a physical situation of being accelerated there and seeing something. There's no real time evolution that corresponds to this. So these are the issues that I have with this perspective. The third one, which is also my favorite, is the detector perspective. So the idea now is that we're going to stick a thermometer into the field, and we're going to see whether this thermometer thermalizes or not. The thermometer is a particle detector. And what I call a particle detector here is a localized non-relativistic quantum system that couples to a quantum field. So it has to be a system that is sufficiently localized, has to couple to a quantum field so that we can probe it. And it's a non-relativistic quantum system, meaning that it's described by its standard quantum mechanics. So for instance, an atom coupled to the electromagnetic field, right? The atom is just a hydrogen atom. Electromagnetic field is a quantum field, and that's it. Whenever I introduce particle detectors, I like to bring this sentence here. So it's from this reference here. From the retinas of our eyes to the solid state sensors in the LHC, we never measure a quantum field other than by coupling something to it. And particle detector models are the theoretical framework for the something. So everything that we ever extract from quantum fields, in a way, has to go through an unrelativistic quantum system that is localized in our lab so that we measure it. Okay, so, and the good thing for us about the under effect is that these particle detectors can be used as thermometers for measuring the under effect. And it's very simple. You put a particle detector uniformly accelerated, and then you ask yourself, is it thermal in the end, right? If the answer is positive, then you say, well, then the field might be in a thermal state as well, or at least if I were to put an atom there, the atom will thermalize to this temperature. So that's what we're going to do. But before doing it, let's see an explicit model of particle detector. This is the simplest one. It's a two-level UDW model. And the idea is you pick a trajectory, in a time-like trajectory in space-time. Its Hamiltonian will be just a two-level system with gap omega. And the interaction between this two-level system and the quantum field is going to be prescribed by this interaction Hamiltonian here. So there are some elements here, but they're not too complicated. This is just a coupling constant. We assume it to be small so that we can do perturbation. This guy here is the space-time smearing function. So this localizes the interaction around the curve in space-time. So the interaction is localized in space from here to here, in time from here to here, and in space from here to here. So this is essentially where the interaction takes place. And finally, we have the detector's monopole moment, which is an operator in the detector Hilbert space in the two-level system, which doesn't commute with its free Hamiltonian. And it's important that it doesn't commute so that the quantum field can promote excitations of the quantum field, essentially. So the sigma plus, sigma minus are the raising and lowering operators, right? They make ground to excite and excited to ground. So this is the simplest particle detector model. And it's important to say that this model, although it looks like someone just came up with a qubit and put in space-time, it's not just a theoretical idealization. If you actually pick this lambda of x properly, then you can actually mimic physical interactions, such as the interaction of atoms with electromagnetism can be mimicked by this, except for some angular momentum exchange details. And also the interactions of nucleons with neutrinos can be modeled by this as well in some scenarios. So this really models physical scenarios that, yeah, nice. And as we saw, as I said before, these detectors can act as thermometers. And in order to check whether they thermalize or not, remember that we have to use perturbation theory in the end because we can't really solve for the full interaction of the quantum field with the detector. So in order to use them as thermometers, we use the excitation ratio of the detector in order to read off its temperature. So the idea is, if you compute, if the detector has an energy gap omega, and you compute this quantity here, which is the leading order excitation probability, ground from excited, divided by the leading order de-excitation probability, if this behaves as an exponential in omega, essentially you can say that the particle detector is in a thermal state of universe temperature beta. And there's an asterisk here because actually there are some assumptions about the ergodicity of interaction and stuff like this. But just you can say it. If that's satisfied, then you can say that it's thermal pretty much for most of the detector interactions at least. So what happens is if you compute now the EDR ratio, the excitation to excitation ratio, for a uniformly accelerated detector in Minkowski spacetime coupled to the vacuum, what you find is, in the limit where the interaction time is long enough, of course, because it has to really thermalize, then you find e to the minus 2 pi over a omega. So once again, we recover the under temperature, but now using these particle detectors, right? So this is the third approach that I wanted to show you. Now, the thing is, there are still some issues with this. The first one is that the calculations are perturbative, so it's harder to talk about thermalization. You have to use some more complicated arguments. And the second one, I wouldn't say that it's a bug. It's like a feature, right? So it's not entirely done within QFT. It requires this external thermometer to probe the temperature. But well, we're trying to describe the thermometer, so it's kind of expected, right? So, all right. Now, let me talk about the contribution that I did to this whole program of the under effect. So essentially, in this manuscript here, what I showed was that it's possible to use detectors to probe the KMS temperature in more general setups. Okay, so I'm going to try to explain very briefly what are these more general setups. So the idea is that if the field satisfies the KMS condition with respect to the time evolution generated locally around the detector, then the detector will also thermalize to this KMS temperature. That's essentially the result. So what do I mean by this local notion of time evolution? So the detector is defined by, around this trajectory, right? And if you pick Fermi normal coordinates, which is a special set of coordinates around this trajectory that really contains the physical information about the what's going on around it, then what happens is that this tau parameter in the Fermi normal coordinates, it corresponds to the proper time of the trajectory, okay? And it extends this notion of proper time locally around the trajectory. So now you can talk about a time evolution that's associated to the trajectory locally around it. And this notion of time evolution then defines a flow that you can now apply to fields, functions, whatever. And this defines an operator in the quantum field if you define it via the action of test functions, essentially, right? So this will define an operation in the quantum field. And this is the alpha tau that we will assume that our field state satisfies the KMS condition with respect to. So we'll assume that the field is KMS with respect to this local notion of time evolution around the detector. In particular, this recovers the Andrew effect in the case of accelerated detectors in Minkowski space. So the Fermi normal coordinates correspond to Rindler coordinates and everything matches, right? And finally, then essentially what was proved is that the detector will thermalize with the KMS temperature of the field if it's rigid and sufficiently small compared to the acceleration and curvature of spacetime. And also if the interaction lasts for sufficiently long times compared to the detector gap. So essentially this rigidity assumption is that the detector shape doesn't change too much because else we can't really do the calculations and it has to be small enough so that this local notion of time evolution compares to the proper time of the trajectory. And the good thing about this result is that it's valid for any particle detector model that couples to any operator in any quantum field theory that is valid in curved spacetimes, whatever, doesn't matter. All of this is pretty much general. It can be a fermionic detector coupled to the neutrino field, can be, well, an atom coupled with the electromagnetic field, uniformly accelerated. If it's uniformly accelerated in flat spacetimes, we see the Andrew effect. But if you put it, for instance, around a black hole, it will be probing the Hawking temperature, right? Because it's also KMS state with respect to the vacuum around the black hole is also KMS state with respect to static trajectories. So yeah, this is essentially the contribution that I did. So the summary of the talk, what I want you to take home from here is thermality in QFT is phrased in terms of the KMS condition, so periodicity in imaginary time. The Minkowski vacuum is a KMS state with respect to this uniformly accelerated time translations. Particle detectors thermalize to the KMS temperature of the field, associated locally with their motion. And this is true for any detector coupled to any operator in any quantum field theory in curved spacetimes. And overall, this can be seen as a generalization of the Andrew effect for particle detectors, at least, or for probing the KMS temperature of the field. So thank you.
Questions?
Yeah, those. Sorry.
So at some point you said that the detector has to be small compared to the curvature.
Yes.
So what does small mean?
It means small compared to the curvature radius of spacetime. So it's
totally flat. That's
No. The spacetime is general, but the size of the detector, the proper size of the detector in its own rest frame, has to be smaller than the curvature radius of spacetime. Has to be much smaller than the curvature radius of spacetime. So that's a very reasonable assumption for most setups that you can picture. They're not like for black holes. They're very So yeah. That's the thing. Yeah. All right. Yeah.
So I guess the takeaway that an accelerating observer sees a thermal distribution for the vacuum state. Is there a setting where you see something like that's not in equilibrium? Like, where would that come from?
I'm sorry, what do you mean by not equilibrium?
I guess it'd be like the function that we see is for some equilibrium system, the e to the minus beta h or the generalizations.
Yeah.
Is there a perturbation on that pushes you away from that distribution? you're changing your acceleration or something?
That's a good question. Yeah. So everything that's being done here, essentially, which is the, when I say that the detector thermalizes, there's this, you see, there's this limit of T going to infinity. So essentially what happens here is that what really matters is that the detector stays in this uniformly accelerated trajectory for long enough times, right? This is time enough, time long enough compared to the one over the gap of the detector. So, and to the acceleration space then. But so the thing is, what really matters is that you stay uniformly accelerated for long enough periods of time, and then we can talk about thermality using the tools that we have to talk about thermal states in equilibrium, right? If it's out of equilibrium, then you're going to see differences here. These differences might depend on the shape of the detector. They might depend on the previous trajectory. They might depend pretty much on everything because, well, out of equilibrium, we don't have a treatment for quantum field theory, for thermality and quantum field theory out of equilibrium. So I guess that you would see something very different, yes. I can't tell you exactly why, but yeah.
Any further questions? If not, then nothing.